keep your voice down. The kids are downstairs watching TV, but I am still afraid they will hear.
No one found it, did they? Not when they were still alive.
No. No one found the church until Claire came to town. According to Josh, they found the church because of a tip. Someone had seen a car in what used to be the parking lot, but was now full of weeds. Millicent stood in front of me, hands on hips. She is still wearing her robe. Behind her, the TV is on in our bedroom. The press has not been let into the church, nor have any pictures been released, so Josh is repeating what his unnamed sources have said.
A vile scene. Chains attached to the walls, iron cuffs drenched in blood. Even a veteran police officer was brought to tears, like something out of a movie.
Millicent flipped her hand, brushing the words away.
It is not drenched with blood. That room isn't a vault, it's a basement. And the church has to be 100 years old. Who knows what's taken place in there?
But you cleaned it? Her eyes narrow.
Are you really asking me that?
I throw up my hands as an answer. Millicent walks up to me, her face closer to mine than when we were still in bed, but there is nothing cozy or warm about her.
Don't you dare second-guess me. Not now.
I'm not.
You are. Stop.
Her robe swishes as she turns around and disappears into the bathroom. I can understand her anger. She is angry the church was discovered, and angry I am questioning her. But I would not have left that basement with a speck of blood in it. The whole thing would have been doused in ammonia or bleach or whatever gets rid of blood and fluids and DNA of any kind. Maybe I would have left behind a lit cigarette inside and let it burn, making it look like an accident. I never got the chance to do any of that, because I did not know about the church. I could never bring myself to ask. Millicent decides we should all go to the movies this afternoon. Given the circumstances, this suggestion is absurd, but I tell myself it has to be better than watching the news all day. Yes, it's a good idea to get out of the house, out of my head, away from Josh. I repeat this as I get dressed, trying to shove aside that church and its basement. It almost works. I'm not feeling very well. For emphasis, I hold my stomach. Millicent gives me the look.
Maybe some popcorn would help.
No, no, you guys go ahead. Have a good time. They leave without me. I do not turn on the news. Instead, I drive out to the church. The TV is not good enough. I want to see it for myself, this place where Millicent kept Lindsay and Naomi alive. It is out on a lonely road between nowhere and nothing. The only buildings along the way are a boarded-up bar, a run-down gas station, and an empty ranch at the end of a private road. This is why I never spotted the church on the GPS. The ranch is up for sale, and the address showed up on the tracker several times. She could walk out the back door of the ranch and be at the church in minutes. No one from the road would be able to see her. The area is flooded with cars, TV vans, and looky-loos. I put on a jacket and baseball cap and try to blend in with the crowd. Reporters are spread out in front of the church, and the steeple rises up behind all of them. They stand right in front of the yellow tape, which is protected by uniformed cops. Some are baby-faced, others are bloated and on the verge of retirement. I've never been this close to Josh, never seen him anywhere other than on TV. He is shorter and thinner than he looks on screen. An older woman is beside me, her eyes shifting between all three reporters.
Excuse me. Do you know if they've said anything new? I ask.
Since when?
Her voice has a smoker's rasp. She has a thick head of white hair and yellowy eyes. About half an hour?
No, you haven't missed anything.
Through a thick block of trees, the top of a white tent is visible. It looks like the same kind used at weddings and kids' parties. What's that?
The police set it up first thing. They call it home base.
The chief's back there, says a man standing behind me. He is large everywhere, standing a good 4 inches taller than me and at least a foot wider.
They want to make sure, he says.
Make sure of what?
Make sure it was just those two women, he says, and not more.
God forbid,
the woman says. There were two others, of course, Holly and Robin, but neither was kept in the basement. Not that I know of, anyway. A bright light flashes on as Josh goes live. Once again, he mentions his sources, none of whom have names. They have given him more information about the underground room beneath the church, and he says they found something, on the wall, hidden in a corner. It looks like someone who was held captive tried to leave a message. 57. For a second, I think about asking Josh if he has any further information. We have never spoken, I have never communicated with him outside of the letters, but this rumor about a hidden message makes me panic. Almost. Instead of doing something stupid like I have so often in the past, I step back, consider, evaluate, and I reach a conclusion. Nonsense. The story is all nonsense. Josh's sources are wrong. If it took the police less than a day to find this so-called message, there is no chance Millicent would have missed it. She may not know her son is sneaking out at night, but she can spot dust from two rooms away. She would not miss a message on the wall. And what kind of message would Naomi or Lindsay leave? Help? I'm trapped? It is unfathomable that Millicent told them her real name, so they wouldn't have been able to leave behind their abductor's identity. The hidden message must be a lie planted by Claire, no doubt to try and draw us out. Anyone who watches TV knows the police lie. This is likely enough to make me walk away, go home, talk to Millicent. When I arrive, the house is empty. I turn on the TV and surf through the news. Josh is still talking about this possible message, but has no further details. A reporter on another channel repeats what Josh has said. The third reporter talks about the church. The Bread of Life Christian Church began with a single family and grew to a congregation of about 50. Old pictures show a stern-looking group with worn faces and tattered clothing. In later years, the group appeared to have prospered, with a lot more bread. They were heavier, and a few even smiled. They peaked in the 50s, and then declined into nothing by the 80s. As far as anyone knew, the building has been empty for at least 20 years. Because it is Sunday, the blueprints from the city planning office are not available, but local historians suspect the basement was part of the original building. It may have been a room for cold storage. I surf between the channels, waiting for something new to happen. Millicent and the kids don't get home until about 5. They spent the afternoon at the movies and the mall, where Jenna got yet another pair of shoes and Rory got a new hoodie. Both run upstairs, leaving Millicent and me alone. Feeling better? She asks. It sounds sarcastic. Not really. She raises an eyebrow. The TV is off. I have no idea how much news she has heard. They're talking about a message, I say.
A what?
Millicent walks into the kitchen to start dinner. I follow her. A message on the wall, left by someone held captive.
Impossible.
I stare at her. She's ripping up lettuce to make a salad. Yeah, that's what I figured, I say.
Here, finish this.
She slides the bowl and lettuce over to me.
I was thinking of tuna melts tonight.
I ate the tuna for lunch.
All of it?
Most. Behind me, the refrigerator door bangs open. She does not say anything, but I can hear her anger. The door slams shut.
I suppose I can throw together an eggplant casserole or something, she says. Sounds perfect.
We work side by side. She slices the eggplant, and I grate cheese for the top of the casserole. When it finally goes into the oven, Millicent turns to me. The circles under her eyes are darker than ever.
I'm sorry about earlier, she says. It's okay. We're both on edge, with Claire and this church and all. Are you scared?
No.
Really?
She sounds surprised. Are you?
No.
Then we're good, right? She slides her arms around my neck.
We're great.
It feels like we are.
I go up to say goodnight to the kids. Rory's light is off, but he is awake and using his phone. Before I can say a word, he says,
"Yes, I'm texting with Faith and Daniel, and I'm playing a game, too."
"Are you doing any of them well?"
He lowers the phone and gives me that look. It is the same as Millicent's.
"And I'm not smoking weed."
As expected, he's still angry.
"So how is the girlfriend?" I ask.
"Faith."
"How is Faith?"
He sighs.
"Still my girlfriend."
"Not sneaking out tonight, are you?"
"Only if you don't."
"Rory."
"Yes, father?"
His voice drips with smartass.
"What lesson do you want to teach me tonight?"
"Good night." I shut the door before he can answer. I do not want to hear it. Not tonight. Jenna is just getting into bed, and I sit down to talk to her. Both the kids already know about the church and the basement under it, the same way they know about everything faster than light. I wish there were a way to stop it, because she is just so young. Not young enough to sleep with stuffed animals, but young enough to keep them around. But she still knows too much about this kind of thing. Girls are abducted and locked up in books, movies, TV shows, and in real life. It would be impossible for her to have missed that, and she hasn't.
"They were chained up down there, weren't they?"
she asks. I shake my head. "We don't know yet."
"Don't lie."
"Probably they were." She nods and turns over on her side toward the nightstand. The light on top has a flower-shaped lampshade. Orange, of course. "How's your stomach been?" I ask.
"It's fine."
"Good."
"Why would someone hurt people like that?"
I shrug. "Some people are just wired wrong. They think bad is good."
"I bet Claire catches him."
"I bet you're right." She smiles a little. I hope she is wrong. 58. The first pictures of the basement are surprising. It does not look like the medieval dungeon I have built up in my head. Instead, it looks like the unfinished basement of an old building. Dirt floor, wooden shelves on the wall, an old staircase. Only the wall farthest from the stairs is different because it is the only one that indicates what may have happened in that basement. The wall has been bricked over and covered in stucco. A jumble of chains and cuffs lie on the ground beside it. Claire introduces the pictures at an evening press conference, and I watch it from inside a bar. It is the same bar I was in when Lindsay's body was found. I nurse a beer and sit where I have a view of a front window. Across the street is the First Street Bar and Grill, where they make giant hamburgers to eat with their giant microbrews, and everything is cheaper than it sounds. Millicent is not a fan of burgers or beer, so we go there only to meet clients or attend a party. Claire goes through each picture and describes the details. There are close-ups of stains on the walls and the dirt floor. They look like rust, but she says they are blood. The bartender shakes his head. No one makes a sound. They are too busy drinking and watching. I cannot imagine Millicent leaving so much blood behind, if that's what it is. Claire might be lying. Her eyes stare right into the camera, so it appears she's looking right at me, or at the guy next to me, or at the bartender. It is unnerving. I hate Claire's pantsuits. Tonight it is navy blue paired with a dark gray blouse. She always looks like she is going to a funeral. Claire stands at a podium near the church, although it isn't close enough to see anything but trees. Not even the steeple is visible. The police chief and the mayor are on one side of her, and an easel is set up on the other. Large copies of the pictures are stacked on it, and a couple of uniformed cops flip through each one as Claire speaks.
"We are already running tests on the blood, comparing it to both Naomi and Lindsay. We also discovered traces of saliva, and those are being tested as well."
She does not take questions.
The whole press conference lasts about 20 minutes, which gives the newscasters and pundits time to dissect it. Claire didn't say anything about a message left on the wall, nor was there a photo of one. The bartender turns the channel to sports news. I order another beer and hardly touch it. 40 minutes later, I see him. Across the street, Josh walks into the First Street Bar and Grill. It is his favorite restaurant. I came across this information by accident while driving down First Street a couple of nights ago. While stuck at a red light, I watched Josh get out of his car and head into the restaurant. The next night, I drove by again and saw his car parked out front. The third night, the same thing. On that evening, I walked by and saw him sitting at the bar alone, drinking a beer while watching TV. I go across the street and sit a few bar stools away from Josh. Since I have already eaten dinner, I order a shot and a beer, same as he does. I look at him and look away. Then I look back, as if I recognize him. Without even glancing in my direction, he says, "Yes, I'm that guy from the news." "I thought that was you. I see you on TV almost every night," I say. Josh looks a lot different in real life. His face does not look as smooth. The texture of his skin is uneven. His nose is red, and so are his eyes. Too bad I didn't bring the eye drops. He sighs and finally turns to me.
"Thanks for watching."
"No, thank you for your reporting. You've really been the go-to guy on that big case, right? The women who were killed?"
"I was."
"You still are. You seem to know everything first." Josh drinks a third of his beer in one gulp.
"Are you one of those true crime freaks?"
"Not at all, just someone who wants this asshole caught."
"Cool."
I motion to the bartender for another shot. "Hey man," I say to Josh, "let me buy one."
"No offense, but I'm not gay."
"None taken. Neither am I." Josh accepts the shot. The bartender brings a couple more beers with it. Together, we watch the sports channel, talking back and forth about this team or that one. I buy a couple more shots, but pour mine into a peanut bowl when he is not looking. Josh drinks his and orders two more. When a soccer game starts, he nods to it.
"I bet on the Blazers. You?"
"Same." "Lie."
"You play? You look like you play."
I shrug. "Not really." He gulps down the rest of his beer and motions for two more.
"I used to play for this soccer team called the Marauders. We sucked, but people were still afraid of us. That was kind of awesome."
"Sounds like it." During a commercial break, an ad for the local news shows today's press conference. Claire Wellington is once again on the screen. Josh shakes his head and looks over at me. His eyes are not as clear as they were when I walked in.
"You want some inside information?" he says.
"Sure." He points to the TV.
"She's a bitch."
"Really?"
"It's not because she's a woman. Really, that's got nothing to do with it. But the problem with having a woman in charge is that they have to change everything, prove themselves, you know? And it's not their fault they have to do that. I get it. I just wish they didn't screw everything up."
"Is that right?"
"That's 1,000,000% right."
The young, earnest reporter I have been watching is not the person he is on TV. I don't know why I expected him to be. I order a couple more shots. Josh drinks his and slams the glass on the bar.
"A couple days ago, I reported something a source told me. The next day, he calls and says, I can't talk about it anymore. Technically, the police can get fired for talking to the press. She's just decided to enforce the rule."
He throws up his hands as if this is an abomination.
"Even if they talk to me, and I worked with the police when I got those letters from Owen, or whoever sent them, I didn't have to do that. I could have just read them on the air without telling the police at all."
"What does that mean?" I ask. "Your sources won't tell you anything."
"Oh, they still tell me stuff. I'm just not allowed to report it on the air. Well, I guess I could, but I'm a nice guy. I don't want anyone to get fired, especially not someone I need.
That bitch won't be here forever." Before I can answer, his phone buzzes. He glances at it and rolls his eyes.
"See, this is what I'm talking about. I get a tip from a source, the second time I've heard this information, but I can't do anything with it. YEO, it says, your eyes only."
He lets out a big, noisy sigh.
Worst acronym ever.
That sucks.
No shit.
I wait. I stare at the TV, not saying a word, hoping to convey that none of this matters to me, because the less I care, the better chance he will tell me. It takes him one more shot.
Okay, I have to tell someone, he slurs. But if you tell anyone, I'll deny I showed you this, at least until they make it public.
You think they will?
They don't have a choice.
Josh slides the phone over to me. The text is on the screen, sent by someone named Jay. The whole thing reminds me a little of being Tobias. Until I read the text. Y-E-O. There are bodies buried under the church. 59. I thought the text was going to be about the supposed message on the wall. Instead, it is about buried bodies. So what? I say.
So what?
Josh says. That church is over 100 years old. There's probably a whole graveyard of people buried there.
I'm sure there is, but that's not what he's talking about.
Josh leans in and lowers his voice a little. The smell of all that alcohol hits me in the face.
Have you been out there?
I almost say yes, but then remember I am not a true crime freak. No.
They have this big tent set up, but it's behind a bunch of trees. That's where they're taking the bodies.
You keep saying that. What bodies?
The bodies in the basement aren't from 100 years ago, he says. They're women who have been killed recently.
No.
Yes, and I can't go on the air with it.
Josh rambles on, complaining all over again about Claire and his sources. I am not listening anymore. Naomi and Lindsay have already been found, which leaves Holly and Robin. Holly was killed out in the middle of nowhere in the woods, and we buried her out there. Robin was killed in our kitchen. Her car and body are at the bottom of a nearby lake. I interrupt Josh. Do you know when this information will be released?
Soon, I'm sure. They can't hide those bodies forever.
He keeps talking, but I think only of Claire Wellington. It will take her about a minute to show up at our door, asking about Millicent's sister, Holly, and why she was never reported missing. Because we thought she just moved away. Because we didn't care. Because she used to torture my wife. Because she was crazy. I text Millicent. We need a date night. She turns me down. No date night. I'm at the hospital. I read it 3 times before throwing money on the bar and leaving First Street Bar and Grill without saying another word to Josh. Or maybe I say I have to go. I'm not sure. Millicent calls me as I'm trying to call her. She is talking fast and I've been drinking, so all I catch are the highlights. Rory, emergency room, fell from the window. I don't bother with the car because I'm close enough to run. The hospital is 3 blocks away, and I arrive to find Millicent pacing in the hall. As soon as I see her, I know. Rory is okay. Or will be. Millicent's fists are clenched, lips pursed, and it feels like an electric current is shooting out of her. If Rory was really hurt, she would be worried, crying, or in shock. But she isn't. She is bursting with anger. She grabs me and hugs me. It is quick and violent. And then she pulls back to sniff my breath. Beer, I say. What happened?
Our son snuck out of the house to see his girlfriend. He fell climbing up to her window.
But he's okay?
He is. We thought his wrist was broken, but it's a bad sprain. He'll have to wear a sling.
Why didn't you call me when it happened? I ask.
I did. I texted you.
I pull out my phone. There it is, right on the cracked screen. Depending on the angle, it can be difficult to read.
Oh, God, I'm sorry. Forget it. You're here now. The important thing is, he's okay.
Millicent's anger is back, if it had ever really left.
He's just grounded for a century.
Someone giggles. Around the corner, Jenna is sitting in a waiting room. She waves. I wave back. Millicent directs me to a vending machine for coffee. It is bitter and burns my tongue and is exactly what I need.
It settles me down instead of the opposite because my heart is beating too fast from the sprint over and the alcohol and my son in the hospital. Millicent disappears into the examining room to be with Rory. When they come out, Rory has a brace on his wrist and a sling on his arm. Millicent's anger has softened, at least for now. He does not look me in the eye. Maybe he is still angry at me, or maybe he knows he is in trouble. Hard to tell, because right now I am torn between knocking him upside the head and hugging him. I ruffle his hair.
If you don't want to play golf, you should have just said so, I say.
He doesn't smile. He loves golfing. We get home after midnight. I check on Rory a few minutes after he goes to bed. Even he falls asleep right away. I sit down on my bed, exhausted. My car is still at the First Street Bar and Grill. And there are bodies buried under the church. Millicent, I say. She comes out of the bathroom halfway through her nighttime routine.
What?
I was drinking beer tonight with Josh, the reporter.
Why would you?
He told me there are bodies buried in that church basement.
Bodies?
I nod, watching her. Her surprise looks genuine.
Did he say whose bodies?
She asks. I assume Holly and Robin.
They aren't anywhere near that church, you know that.
She walks away, back into the bathroom. I follow her. You really don't know anything about the bodies buried down there?
Absolutely not.
There's just a pile of random bodies in a church basement.
Jesus, I don't know. This is the same reporter who claimed there was a message on the wall. Where's that?
She has a point. Maybe Josh has it wrong. Or maybe someone is feeding him lies to keep him from the truth. Fictional police do that all the time. And Claire might be just as smart as they are. 60. Now that Millicent has discovered that Rory has a girlfriend and has been sneaking out to see her, she wants to meet with Faith's parents to discuss the situation. The Hammonds are clients of hers, and they readily agree that we should all meet for dinner. Neither Rory nor Faith is invited. We are on the way to the restaurant, a traditional place with white tablecloths and a menu of comfort foods, their choice, not Millicent's.
They're reasonable people,
Millicent says. I'm sure they are, I say. When we arrive, the Hammonds are already waiting at the table. Hank Hammond is small and blonde like his daughter. Corinne Hammond is not small and not a natural blonde. Both wear classic clothes and polite smiles. We get straight to the food. No one orders wine. Hank's voice is twice as big as his body.
Faith is a good girl. She never snuck out until she met your son, he says.
I can almost see the ball swing over to our court. Millicent smiles, polite and syrupy.
I could say the same thing about your daughter, but blame isn't going to get us anywhere.
I'm not talking about blame. I'm talking about keeping them away from each other.
You want to ban Rory and Faith from seeing each other?
Faith is already banned from seeing your son anywhere but at school, Hank says. I suppose that's impossible to avoid.
You could homeschool her, Millicent says. That way they would never see each other.
I put my hand on Millicent's arm. She shakes it off.
Perhaps your son is the one who needs homeschooling, Hank says.
Corinne nods.
You really think that forbidding them to see each other will make them stop seeing each other?
Millicent says.
Our daughter will do what she's told, Hank says.
I can feel Millicent biting her tongue because I'm doing the same thing. Corinne breaks the tension. Her voice is stronger than expected.
It's for the best, she says.
Millicent shifts her eyes to Corinne and pauses before saying,
I don't make it a habit of just banning my kids from doing something.
Lie.
I guess that's where we differ,
Hank says. Perhaps we should get back to the subject at hand, I say. I don't think we need to get into our parenting philosophies.
Fine, Hank says. You keep your son away from my daughter, and that's the end of it.
The check arrives, and Millicent grabs it before Hank can. She hands it to me and says, "We've got it." The dinner ends with a terse goodbye. Millicent is silent on the way home. Rory is waiting at the door when we walk into the house. He has a sprained wrist, cannot play golf, and he is grounded. Faith is the only thing he has, or thought he had. I am not looking forward to telling him he has lost her, too. Except we don't. Millicent walks over to Rory and places her hand on his cheek.
"All good,"
she says.
"All good? Really? Just don't ever sneak out again. I promise."
Rory scampers off with his phone to call Faith, who will get a different message from her parents. Millicent winks at me. I wonder if this is how some girls learn to be so sneaky. From someone else's mother. The next day, we get a call from the school. Jenna, not Rory. And this time, it is not about a weapon or her stomach. Now, it's her grades. She's always been an honor student, but her grades have fallen over the past month. Today, she neglected to turn in a paper that was due. Jenna didn't even give her teacher an excuse. Neither Millicent nor I had a clue. Jenna has been such a good student, I don't even check the weekly reports posted online. After a flurry of texts and calls, we decide to talk to her after dinner. Millicent begins by telling her about the phone call from school and then says,
"Tell us what's going on."
Jenna has no real answer, other than some hems and haws and a shake of her head.
"I don't understand," Millicent says. "You've always been an excellent student."
"What's the point?"
Jenna says. She stands up from the bed and walks across the room.
"If someone can just lock me up in a basement and torture me, what's the point?"
"No one will do that to you," I say.
"Bet those dead women believe that."
Another punch to the gut. This one feels like an ice pick. Millicent takes a deep breath. Ever since meeting Claire, Jenna seemed to be better. She talked about being a detective all the time. But it all stopped when we found out about the church. We go around in circles with her, trying to use logic to take away her fear. It does not really work. All we get is a promise that she will not flunk any of her classes. As we walk out of Jenna's room, I see a notebook lying open on her bed. She has been researching how many women are abducted and murdered each year. Millicent gets on the phone, trying to find another therapist. This is on the third day without new information about the church. Claire holds a press conference every evening to repeat what we already know. Day 4 begins with a barking dog. We have several in the neighborhood, so there's no telling which one wakes me up at 5 in the morning, but it will not stop barking. I sit up in bed, wondering why it never hit me before. A dog. One big enough to make Jenna feel safe and protective enough to bark when someone is outside, like Rory when he tries to sneak in and out. I could kick myself for not thinking of it sooner. A dog would solve so many of our problems. For once, I am up before Millicent. When she comes downstairs in her running clothes, I'm drinking coffee and researching dogs on the internet. She freezes when she sees me.
"Do I want to know why you're..."
"Look," I say, pointing at the screen. "He's at the shelter, a Rottweiler boxer mix." Millicent takes the coffee out of my hand and helps herself to a sip.
"You want a dog?"
"For the kids, to protect Jenna and to keep Rory from sneaking out." She looks at me and nods.
"That's kind of brilliant."
I have my moments.
"You'll take care of this dog?"
"The kids will." She smiles.
"If you say so."
I take that as a yes. On a break between lessons, I stop by the shelter. A nice woman gives me a tour while I explain what we are looking for. She recommends a few different dogs, and one is the Rottweiler boxer mix. His name is Digger. She checks the paperwork and says he would be a good family dog, but the kids have to come to the shelter and meet him before they'll allow us to adopt. I promise the woman I will be back. The dog makes me feel a little optimistic. I stop at a drive-thru for an iced coffee and a panini. As I sit at the pickup window waiting for my lunch, the TV inside is visible. Claire Wellington is having another press conference. The words at the bottom of the screen make my heart jump. Additional bodies discovered in church. When the cashier slides the window open to hand me the food, I hear Claire's voice.
The bodies of three young women have been found buried in the basement.
I listen to the rest of the press conference in the parking lot on my car radio. Three women. All were murdered recently. The police have to be wrong about the timing. There is no way someone buried bodies while Lindsay was...
At least two of the three were recent enough for investigators to identify how they were murdered. Like the others, they were strangled. There are also signs of torture.
I cannot catch my breath because Claire does not stop talking.
We also found words written on the wall of the basement, behind a shelf. While we do not have the DNA tests back yet, the blood type matches Naomi's.
When Claire says the words on the wall, my heart stops. Tobias. Death. 61. Naomi could not have written Tobias's name. She had never met him. I turn this over in my mind, trying to figure out how it happened. Lindsay knew Tobias. She knew he was deaf. But her body was found before Naomi disappeared. They could not have spoken, could not have exchanged information like that. Millicent was the only one. It does not make sense. None of this does. As I get my food and drive out, I turn on the radio to hear the end of the press conference. When it's over, the announcers keep talking. They say those words on the wall again and again. Tobias. Death. Naomi didn't know about Tobias. Lindsay did. And Millicent. I pull over to the side of the road. My mind is so muddled I cannot think and drive at the same time. Tobias. Death. I turn the radio off and close my eyes. All I see is Naomi in the basement of the church, chained up on that wall. I try to force it from my mind to think clearly, but I still see her, huddled in a corner, dirty and covered in blood. It makes me sick. Bile rises in my throat. I taste it in my mouth. I step out of the car, feeling nauseous, and the phone rings. Millicent. She is already talking when I answer the call.
Flat tire? She says.
Excuse me?
You're sitting on the side of the road.
I look up as if a drone or a camera is looking down on me, but the sky is clear, not even a bird. How do you know where I am? She sighs, a big, exasperated sigh, and I hate when she does that.
Look under the car, she says.
What?
Under the car.
I kneel down and look.
A tracker. Just like the one I'd put on her car. That's why I never knew about the church. She knew I was tracking her.
The realization of what is happening explodes like a bomb in my head. There is only one person who could have written that message using Naomi's blood. I knew this when I heard about it. I've just been looking for another explanation. There isn't one. You set me up, I say. For all of them. Lindsay, Naomi.
And the other three. Don't forget about them.
My mind is flooded with images of Millicent killing women alone, framing me for the murders. Now I know what she has been doing while I was at home with Jenna all those days and nights when she was sick. The future rolls out in front of me like a bloody red carpet. I close my eyes, lean my head back, and think of all the ways Millicent could set me up. All the DNA she has access to, everything she could plant, could give to the police. That does not even include the people who knew me as a deaf man named Tobias, Annabelle, Petra, even the bartenders. They will remember. Everything will point to me. My mind fights against this idea. Around in circles I go, mapping out an idea, following it to the end, realizing it will never work. Every path is blocked, every idea already thought of by Millicent.
It feels like a giant maze with no exit. I'm not a planner, after all. Not like my wife. I pace up and down the length of the car. My head feels like it's being shocked again and again. Millicent, why would you do this? She laughs. It sounds like a bite.
Open your trunk.
What?
Your trunk, she says. Open it.
I hesitate, imagining what could be inside, wondering how much worse it could get.
Do it,
she says. I open the trunk. Nothing inside except my tennis equipment. Not a single racket out of place.
What are you?
The spare tire,
she says. My phone, the disposable one. The one with messages from Lindsay and Annabelle. I reach inside the rim of the tire, but I don't find it. Instead, I find something else. Pixie sticks. Lindsay. The first one I slept with. It happened after that second hike. You're cute. That's what Lindsay had said. No, you're the cute one. Millicent's voice brings me back to now.
You know, it's amazing what people will tell you when they're locked up for a year.
What are you?
She saw you the night we took her. Lindsay was waking up before you left. She was pretty surprised you weren't deaf, actually.
A wave of nausea hits because of what I did, because of what my wife has done.
The funny thing,
she says,
is that Lindsay thought I was torturing her because she slept with you. I tried to tell her it wasn't like that, not at first anyway, but I don't think she ever believed me.
Millicent, what have you done?
I didn't do anything,
Millicent says.
You did. You did all of this.
I don't know what you think happened.
Do not patronize me with a denial.
I bite my tongue until I taste blood. How long have you been planning this?
Does it matter?
No, not anymore.
Can I explain? I ask.
No.
Millicent.
What, you're sorry? It just happened and it didn't mean anything?
I bite my tongue, literally.
So what are you going to do?
She says.
Run and hide? Or stay and fight?
Neither. Both.
Please don't do this.
See, this is your problem.
What?
You always focus on the wrong things.
I start to ask her about what the wrong things are, but stop myself. I am making her point. She laughs. The line goes dead.
62. I should get sick. I should vomit up whatever is in my stomach, because when my wife of 15 years has set me up for murdering multiple women, this should make me sick to my stomach. Instead, it feels like my whole body has been injected with Novocaine. Not a bad thing, because I can think instead of feel. Run and hide, stay and fight. Neither is appealing, nor is prison, the death penalty, lethal injection. Run. First, I take stock. Car, half a tank of gas, panini, partial iced coffee, and about 200 in cash. Credit cards I cannot use because Millicent will be watching. I wonder if there is time to make a cash withdrawal at the bank. Beyond that, my options narrow considerably. Can't keep the car for long unless I get rid of the license plate, and then there is the issue of where to go. Canada is too far. By the time I make it there, my picture will be all over the news. Mexico is the only driving option, and even that would be a stretch. It depends on how quickly this all plays out. My name and picture could be out within hours. I could fly out of the country, but then I would definitely need to use my passport. They would know where I landed. At no time did I prepare for this kind of escape. Millicent knows this. Running will get me caught. It also means leaving my kids. With Millicent. Now I get sick. On the side of the road, behind my car, I empty my stomach. I do not stop until there is nothing left. Run and hide. Stay and fight. I start to consider a third option.
What if I just walk into a police station and tell them everything? No. Millicent might be arrested, but so would I. Claiming innocence is not an option, because it is not true. There has to be a way, though. A way to implicate her instead of me, because I never killed anyone. A deal could be made with the right lawyer, the right prosecutor, the right proof. Except I don't have any. Unlike Millicent, I have not been setting up my spouse for murder. You always focus on the wrong things. Maybe she's right. Maybe the why does not matter, but it will. The why is what will haunt me, what I will think about at night when I am lying in bed, if I am in a bed. Maybe it will be a prison cot. She is right about the why. It's the wrong thing to think about. Run and hide. Stay and fight. The options repeat over and over like those words written on the wall of the basement. Millicent stated these options as if they were the only ones that existed, as if it were an either-or choice. She is wrong. The options are wrong. First, I will stay. Leaving my kids isn't going to happen. And if I stay, I have to hide, at least until I can find a way to make the police believe me about Millicent. That means I have to fight. Stay, hide, fight. The first is easy. No running. The police. I could go to the police and tell them everything. Tell them, no, cannot do that. I have real blood on my hands, and even a rookie will figure that out. And if I cannot go to the police, I will have to avoid them. Money. I have $200 in my wallet, and that will not last long. I head straight to the bank and withdraw as much cash as I can without triggering an alert to the IRS. Millicent will know about it because the tracker is still on my car. Millicent. How long did she know? How long has she been tracking me? When did she start to plan this? The questions are endless, unanswerable. With all we have been through, with all we have done together, it is unfathomable to me that she did not talk to me, ask me about it, even give me the benefit of the doubt. Instead, I had no chance, no opportunity to explain. It seems a little bit crazy and heartbreaking. But I do not have time to think about either one. In less than an hour, my life has been reduced to its most base level, survival. So far, I am not very good at it. Millicent knows where I am, and I have no idea what to do next. Home. It is still where I always go. I grab what I can, clothes, toiletries, my laptop. The one we used to search for the women is gone, probably destroyed, but I find Millicent's tablet and take it. And photographs. I take a couple of pictures of the kids right off the walls. I also send them a text. Don't believe everything you hear. I love you. Before leaving, I turn off the GPS tracker, but keep it with me. For a while, she will wonder if I am just sitting in our house. Maybe, but that is assuming I know my wife at all. I pull out of the driveway and drive down the street, having no idea where to go next. An empty building, a roadside motel, a parking lot, the swamp, the woods, the hiking trails. I have no idea, but it does not seem smart to be in a place I am unfamiliar with. I need somewhere quiet, somewhere I can think, somewhere no one will bother me for a few hours. A complete lack of options and originality sends me to the country club. As an employee, I have a key to the office, which I never use, along with the equipment rooms and the courts. I make a quick stop at the store for a bag of food, mostly junk, and stay out of sight until after 9 o'clock. That's when the lights are shut down on the tennis courts and security locks them up for the night. This is where I go. The club has cameras inside the building. There are none on the courts. 63. Everything about the tennis courts is familiar. I grew up here, on these courts. This is where I learned to play tennis, but that wasn't all I did. My coach made me run around these courts endless times to get into shape. I won trophies here and had my butt whipped, sometimes on the same day. This was my escape. This is where I came to get away from my friends, school, and especially my parents. At first, I came here to see if they would look for me. When they never did, I used it as a hideout.
I even had my first kiss here.
Lily.
She was a year older than me, and far more experienced, or so it seemed. On Halloween night, about a million years ago, my friends and I dressed up as pirates. She and her friends dressed up as baby dolls. We all ran into each other somewhere in the Oaks while trick-or-treating, and Lily told me I was kind of cute. I assumed that meant she loved me, and I think she did. One comment led to another, and it wasn't long before I asked if she wanted to go somewhere cool. She said yes. Cool might have been an exaggeration, but when I was 13, I thought it was cool to be outside the house at night with a girl. Lily didn't think it was too bad either because she kissed me. She tasted like chocolate and licorice, and I loved it. For a second, I am so enveloped by this memory that everything seems okay. It is not. I am on this tennis court because the police are after me and I cannot go home. But thinking about Lily makes me realize I do have somewhere to go. The alarm on my phone wakes me up at 5. I jump up, gather my things, and get into my car. Trying to sleep on a courtside bench gave me plenty of time to come up with a plan. The internet on my phone helped make it a good one. Turns out there are dozens of websites that explain how to disappear, how to go off the grid, how to elude the police, your boss, or your angry wife. Everyone wants to escape something. I drive out of town down the interstate and do not stop for at least an hour. Eventually, I pull into a gas station, turn on the GPS tracker, and attach it to the bottom of a semi. After taking the battery out of my phone, I stop at a convenience store and buy a cheap disposable. Then I head back to Hidden Oaks. The internet does not recommend this part, but the internet does not have children. If I didn't, I would keep driving, change the license plate on my car, or get rid of it altogether, take a Greyhound from state to state, and eventually end up in Mexico. Not an option. Not when Jenna and Rory are still with my wife. Halfway back, I stop and buy a trunk full of groceries. I check all the papers, looking for my own face, but I do not see it anywhere. The headlines are just those two words, Tobias Deaf. As I drive back toward home, I wonder if I'm being stupid all over again. There are two gates at the Oaks. The front gate is where the guards are. You have to pass them to get in. But Hidden Oaks is quite large, given that it has an entire golf course as well as hundreds of homes, so there is a back gate, or rather two of them. One requires a code, the second an opener like the kind used for a garage, but there are no guards. This is where I enter. Once inside, I drive past the less expensive homes, through the mid-range development, and finally arrive at a house twice as large as mine. It has 6 bedrooms, at least that many bathrooms, and a pool in the back. Kokona's house is empty, because she is still in Hawaii. This is the most brilliant part of my plan. Or the stupidest. I will not know until I try to get in. This is where Lily lived. On that Halloween night, she became my first girlfriend. So many nights I snuck out of my house and into hers, just like my son does with his girlfriend now. It has been many years since I have done it, and the house has been repainted, remodeled, and updated. The locks have probably changed several times. But that's the thing about real estate. People always change the locks on the front and back doors. I am betting the lock on the French doors around back, on the second-story widow's walk, has never been changed. The lock on those doors never closed properly. It did not need a key. Climbing up is not as easy at my age as it was back then, but I am not worried about being seen. Kokona's house is deep in the middle of the Oaks, in the expensive area where everyone has more land than they need. The closest neighbors are barely visible from the front, let alone the back. Somehow, I make it up without falling, and sure enough, I know before I even try. The doors have been painted, maybe even resealed, but the lock is the same. I smile for the first time in 24 hours. Minutes later, I am inside, and then back out through the garage. Kokona has one car, an SUV, which leaves an extra space in her garage for mine. I bring in the groceries, take a shower, and get settled. For the first time, I feel like I have a chance, A chance at what, I am not sure, but at least I am no longer sleeping on a tennis court. When I open my laptop, problem number one hits. The wireless password. Kokona has removed the code sticker from the bottom of the modem, so the password does not come easily. It takes me far too long to realize the sticker is right on the refrigerator door. Once online, I search for a way into Millicent's tablet. It requires a 4-digit PIN. I know without trying that she would never use a generic birth date or anniversary. I need a better way. On the news, they won't stop talking about the press conference, about Tobias, and about the three women in the basement. I try to figure out who they are, who Millicent would have chosen. Women from our list? Women I had rejected, like Annabelle or Petra? I hope it is not Annabelle. She didn't do anything to deserve Millicent. No, that wouldn't make sense. Someone has to be alive to identify a deaf man named Tobias. She couldn't have killed everyone who has seen him. Maybe Millicent chose strangers, women I have never even seen or spoken to. Or maybe that would be too random for her. I tell myself to stop. My mind is going in circles and getting nowhere. I keep working on the tablet, hoping to find answers. By the time the sun goes down, I am no closer to getting into it. It is 6 o'clock, and I should be at home eating dinner. Tonight is movie night, and I am not there. If my text didn't let Rory and Jenna know something is wrong, my absence will. I wake up thinking I am at home. I listen for Millicent downstairs, back from her run, making breakfast. Today's schedule runs through my mind. My first lesson is at 9. I roll over and hit the floor with a thud. Not at home. I slept on the couch in Kokona's great room. Her seafoam green sectional is huge, but I still roll right off it. Reality hits with the wood floor. The TV goes on, the single-serve coffee brews, the computer boots up. I spent the previous night making lists. What I know, what I don't know, what I need to know, how to get the info I need. The last list is a little short because I am neither a hacker nor a detective. What I do know is that there are two ways to go about this. Prove she killed those women, or prove I didn't kill them. Ideally, both. On the night Naomi went missing, I went home and stayed with the kids, leaving Millicent alone with her. Same with Lindsay. I was with Jenna because she was sick. The kids are my alibi, and they're not a good one. Once they were asleep, they cannot verify anything. But can I prove Millicent did it? Not any more than I can prove I didn't. Millicent's tablet is a larger problem than I thought. Although there is software available to reset a PIN, it can be done only if I am signed into the email address on the tablet. Another password I do not have and can't even guess. In the middle of the night, I resorted to reading hacker message boards populated by teenagers looking for the same thing I was. There could be another way, maybe, but only if I can convince someone to help me. I spend half the morning wondering if it is better to ask now, before my face is all over the news, or after I am a wanted man. I try to imagine someone coming to me for help, someone who may or may not be a psychopath. Would I help them, or slam the door and call the police? The answer is the same. It depends. And my options are limited. My friends are Millicent's friends. We share them. I have many clients, but most are just that. Just one possibility comes to mind, the only person who might be both willing and able to help. If Andy will agree. 64. The Golden Wok is a Chinese buffet 30 minutes outside Hidden Oaks. I have been there once on my way to somewhere else, and it is like every other Chinese buffet I've seen. I arrive early and fill up my plate with Mongolian beef, sweet and sour pork, chicken chow mein, and fried spring rolls. Halfway through the meal, Andy Preston walks in and joins me. I stand up and offer my hand. He pushes it aside and gives me a hug. Andy is not the same man I knew before Trista killed herself. He is not even the same man I saw at her funeral. The extra weight he carried is gone. Now he is almost too thin, not healthy. I tell him to grab a plate,
The Chinese buffet was his choice. He left Hidden Oaks after Trista died, and Kokona told me he quit his job and spends his days on the internet, encouraging strangers not to kill themselves. I believe it. Andy sits down at the table and gives me a smile. It looks hollow. So what's going on? I say. How are you? Not great, but it could be worse. It could always be worse. I nod, impressed he can say something like that after what has happened to him. You're right. It can. What about you? How's Millicent? I clear my throat. Uh-oh, he says. I need help. He nods, doesn't ask a single question, because he is still my friend, even if I haven't been much of one to him. All morning, I have gone back and forth about how much to tell Andy about my situation. First, the tablet. I take it out of my gym bag and slide it across the laminate table. Can you help me get into this? It has a PIN code, and I have no idea what it is. Andy looks at the tablet and then at me. His eyes look a bit more alert. Any 8-year-old could get into this thing. I can't ask my kids to do it. So this is Millicent's. I nod. But it's not what you think. No? No. I gesture to his plate. Finish eating, then I'll tell you everything. I say everything, but I do not mean it. After we are done, we go sit in his truck. It's an old pickup and nothing like the sports car he used to drive. What did you do? He says. What makes you think I've done something? He side-eyes me. You look like hell. You have a new phone number, and you want to get into your wife's computer. As much as I want to tell someone everything, I cannot. No matter how far we go back, there are limits to friendship. Murder is one of them. So is keeping secrets about a friend's wife. I cheated on Millicent, I say. He does not look surprised. Not a good move, I'm guessing. That's an understatement. So she kicked you out and wants everything? The house, the 401k, the kids' college fund? I wish that was all she wanted. Not exactly, I say. Millicent wants more than that. Can't say I'm surprised. He pauses for a second, shaking his head. Now that you've gone and screwed it all up, I can tell you the truth. What truth? I never liked Millicent. She always seemed a little cold. I feel the urge to laugh, but that seems inappropriate. She's setting me up for some things I didn't do. Some very bad things. Illegal things? He says. Yes. Very much yes. He holds up a hand as if to stop me from saying more. So I was right. She is cold. You were right. He doesn't say anything for a few minutes. He runs his hand around the steering wheel, the type of thing someone does without thinking because they're too busy thinking. It's all I can do to keep my mouth shut, to let him decide how insane I am. If all you needed was to get into that tablet, why tell me the rest? He says. Because you and I go way back. I owe you the truth. And? And because I'll probably be in the news soon. The news? What the hell is she doing to you? You're the first one who has seen me since yesterday. I say, please don't tell anyone. He stares out the window at the neon Golden Walk sign. I don't want to know more, do I? I shake my head no. That's the real favor, then, he says. Keep my mouth shut. Sort of. Yes, but I do need to get into that, I say, pointing to Millicent's tablet. It is sitting on Andy's dashboard. Will you help me? Again, he is quiet. Andy is going to do it. He may not know it, but he has already decided to help. Otherwise, he would have been gone by now. And by the way he looks, he may need this as much as I do. You've always been a pain in the ass, he says. And for the record, your tennis lessons are way too expensive.
I smile a little. Noted. But you accused me of sleeping with your wife. You owe me. He nods. Give it to me. I give him the tablet. The waiting is the worst, like knowing a bomb will go off, but not when or where or who. I spend the next day in Kokona's theater room. It has a screen as wide as the wall and distressed leather recliners. I watch Josh talk about Tobias nonstop. He even speaks to experts about what it is like to be deaf. I have to admit, some of the information is interesting. It would have been useful to have back when I needed it. The breaking news music interrupts my musings. The picture on the screen makes my heart jump. Annabelle. Sweet Annabelle, the meter maid whose boyfriend was killed by a drunk driver. She is alive. And she is still cute as ever, with her short hair and delicate features. But she is not smiling. She does not look happy at all when Josh introduces her as a woman who has encountered the deaf man named Tobias. It is not surprising that she is the first to come forward. She could not save her boyfriend, so she wants to save everyone else. Annabelle tells our story as she knows it, beginning with the moment she almost ticketed the car I claimed was mine. She explains how we bumped into each other on the street, and I invited her to join me for a drink. She even names the bar. If Eric, the bartender, has not already come forward, he will. Annabelle leaves out nothing, not even the text she sent me. The police will now have that phone number. I wonder if Millicent will answer when they call. Last but not least, Annabelle says she spent the morning with a sketch artist. The drawing is released right after the interview ends. It looks exactly like me, and at the same time, nothing like me. I imagine Millicent watching this and critiquing the drawing, saying that the nose is a bit too big and maybe the eyes are too small. She would say they miss the mole by my ear or the shade of my skin is different. She would see everything, because she always does. It will not be long before I am identified, although people must already be looking for me. My employer, for one. Millicent must be acting frantic, pretending I have just vanished without a reason. Jenna and Rory. Who knows what they think? I spend the rest of the day inside, afraid to go out while it is still light. It makes me think back to the day I married Millicent at her parents' home in the middle of nowhere. I can see her in that simple dress with her hair up and sprinkled with tiny flowers, like she was some kind fairy or nymph that came from another world. She was like that. Everything about her was otherworldly. Still is, I suppose. I also think of what she said that day, because it is so appropriate now. Here we go. The news starts to break faster, which is no surprise. The public has been given just enough information to provide more of it. The second person who claims to know Tobias is a bartender, but not Eric. This young man works at the bar where I met Petra. Josh, while overexcited about all the news, seemed rather disappointed in this young man because he does not remember the exact day nor time he met Tobias. He remembers so little it is almost embarrassing, at least for him. To top it all off, he gets the drink wrong. Tobias never ordered a vodka tonic. I am almost offended by this. I always believed Tobias was more memorable than that. Or maybe this bartender is just a moron. When nothing new is happening, everything is repeated. I see Annabelle's interview over and over. They repeat the best parts until I have them memorized. During commercial breaks, I wonder if my kids are watching the same channel. I know Millicent is. I can just see her sitting on the couch watching Annabelle on our big TV. In my mind, Millicent is smiling or scowling. Both. By the evening news, Eric shows up, but on another channel. Josh does not get this interview. The reporter who interviews him is a middle-aged woman, one of our more famous local personalities. Up until now, I have not seen her covering anything about this case, not when Owen was back and not when he turned out to be dead. The fact that she has become involved worries me. A serious manhunt is about to begin, or already has, and they are all looking for me.
Eric remembers more than the last bartender, beginning with the drink, gin and tonic. He describes my suit, right down to the type of tie I had been wearing. He remembers the color of my eyes, my tan, even the length of my hair. Each new revelation makes my stomach turn. Somehow, I manage to find the only bartender in town with a photographic memory. Within minutes, the other stations repeat what Eric said. It makes me a little sick to hear Josh repeat all those personal things about me. I wish I had known what a horrible person he really is. If I did, I never would have sent letters to him. Though I suppose I am not one to judge who is horrible and who is not. Hour after hour goes by, deep into the night, before the old movies and infomercials begin. I open my laptop and search the true crime sites. The sketch is everywhere, along with all the same interviews I just watched, and I scan through all the message boards. My name is not there, nor should it be. Not yet, anyway. 65. I do not sleep for long. Within an hour of my waking up, the news stations have set up for a press conference by Claire Wellington. Coffee makes my stomach turn as I wait for it to start. Claire has not said anything good yet, and I know she will not this morning. A podium is set up at the police station. It is flanked by the U.S. and state flags and surrounded by microphones, cameras, and lights. 10 minutes after the scheduled time, Claire walks to the podium. She is not wearing a pantsuit. Today it is a navy skirt and a matching jacket, which is similar to the type of suits Millicent wears, only not as tight. Somehow, I know this is a bad sign. Claire begins with the sketch that has already been released, and she asks the community to post it at businesses, schools, and civic buildings, as well as on community websites. Although anyone who has not seen it by now doesn't have a TV or the internet, or is in a coma. But this is not why Claire is having a press conference. This is just her opening act. The main event comes next.
Now, I have an update on the three women we found in the church basement. Trying to identify them is a painstaking process, given the varying amounts of decomposition. Their fingerprints have also been removed.
She pauses, takes a deep breath.
Despite the difficulties, the Woodview